When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. There's no easy way to tell you this, but politicians are coming for you. They could turn up at any moment. Stay alert. Keir Starmer making a big speech today. What a New Year treat that is. I wonder if his dad is a toolmaker. And Rishi Sunak could be coming to a street near you. We're told he's going to get out and about and speak to voters direct. We asked today, does the Let Rishi Be Rishi strategy stack up? Before that, our columnists Manveen Rana and Matthew Syed on the post office scandal, which is gripping the nation all over again, thanks to that ITV drama. And don't forget, if you like what you hear here, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, we begin with some breaking news.
A major capital letters big news story.
Yes, thank you, Michael Gove. Now, you'll remember that at the end of last year, thick as mash, spudge you hate, former Tory MP and vaccine scaremonger Andrew Bridgen parted company with Lawrence Fox's Reclaim Party, citing a difference in the direction of the party. Well, the Guido Fawkes website has got the scoop. Yeah, apparently Andrew Bridgen borrowed the Reclaim Party's company car before Christmas to do a bit of constituency work. Then Lawrence Fox called Andrew Bridgen and asked for the car back so that he could pick up a Christmas tree. Andrew Bridgen said no, according to Guido. Lawrence Fox said he'd report the car to the police as missing or stolen if Andrew Bridgen didn't give it back. Andrew Bridgen said no again and then resigned from the party. Well, Guido Fawkes is calling Carmageddon. Andrew Bridgen tells the Guido Fawkes website he's grateful for all the help Reclaim gave me over the 9 months.
Thank you, baked potato.
So there we are. That is the big news about Andrew Bridgen's world. He quit the Reclaim Party because Lawrence Fox wanted the car back so he could pick up a Christmas tree. And now some showbiz news. Yes, the nominations for the Oscars are announced in just a couple of weeks' time. And we have a late entry for Best Actor in a role featuring an MP playing himself.
We've just heard from Bob, who is independent, that you have not. You are the head of the organisation. Will you provide the information, yes or no?
This is the first time that I have been asked for this information.
Yes or no?
I am not aware.
Will you provide it, yes or no?
Yes, Nadeem Zahawi on the telly box last night in Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Nadeem Zahawi playing Nadeem Zahawi. I thought he was quite good. It's quite convincing as Nadeem Zahawi. I just hope he pays his tax if he got a fee.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew. on Times Radio.
Yes, it's Thursday, so of course we are joined by Manveen Rana, host of the Stories of Our Times podcast. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
Happy
New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. I notice you've avoided coming into the studio, so we haven't got any nice snacks.
I'm sorry. Next week, I
know,
promise.
You know, we're all trying to be healthy, first week of Jan. And this week's Matthew is Times, the Sunday Times columnist Matthew Syed. Matthew, how are you?
Good morning. How's it going?
Very good. Happy New Year to you. Now, Keir Starmer has been making a big speech this morning, his first of the year, setting out how Labour is a party of service with a plan, he says. He wants to end the mood of despair in the country. And it strikes me that he's trying to slightly dial up the mood of optimism, not least because when he was at Tony Blair's centrist dad fest thing last year, the Tony Blair Institute's, you know, big conference, he spoke to Tony Blair and he was contrasting the mood for this election with the mood in 97.
The mood then was one of growing optimism. That song, Things Can Only Get Better, that's not the position now, by a long shot.
So suggesting that things might get worse didn't seem very good. So this morning he's been speaking in Bristol and tried to be a bit more hopey-changey.
To truly defeat this miserablest Tory project, we must crush their politics of divide and decline with a new Project Hope. Not a grandiose utopian hope, not the hope of the easy answer, the quick fix, the miracle cure. People have had their fill of that from politicians over the last 14 years. No, they need credible hope, a frank hope, a hope that levels with you about the hard road ahead.
That's just when I heard that. I wondered if Frank Hope was a Labour candidate standing in a key seat. Is this hopey-changey enough, Manveen?
I mean, I don't think anyone's going to hear Keir Starmer and his particularly sort of flat voice talking of Project Hope and thinking everything's about to get much better. I think, to be fair to him, though, the difference between his run-up to the election and Tony Blair's is the underlying state of the economy, isn't it? I mean, he's sort of more in a position of sort of Cameron, you know, the first time he got in, when you know there's austerity coming and there's only so much you can promise. You know, you can talk about a sunny uplands, but you don't really know when they're coming. And really your best bet is to criticise what the person before has done. Whereas with Tony Blair, there was a sense that the economy was already getting better. It was turning and they were going to come in and sort of feel the fruits of this. And you see it now in the dilemma where, you know, we've heard that Labour, in their sort of hopey, changey way, have been thinking about introducing tax cuts, but then also knowing that everyone knows that's not really possible right now. So any politician of any party, whether it's the Tories or Labour, talking of tax cuts just feels slightly irresponsible. We've been through the Liz Truss era. We know where this ends. And we know where the economy is. So I think it's quite difficult for him to be hopey-changey, knowing that actually whoever wins the next election is going to be in for quite a tough time.
I mean, Matthew, I suppose there's a balance to be struck, isn't it? Because you think if even Keir Starmer can't sound that enthusiastic about a Labour government, you sort of think, well, you're the one who's supposed to be all upbeat and optimistic, and other people can sort of temper that.
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting. I was just reflecting as Manveen was speaking about the build-up to 97, and it was an unimaginably different geopolitical context. The fall of the Berlin Wall had happened a few years earlier. It was an age of cheap fossil fuels. America and the Western Alliance at the height of its power. More countries were becoming democratic. It felt like the future was liberal democracy and sustained economic growth driven by cheap energy. That was largely an illusion, I think we can now see. Fossil fuels started to change in terms of their price and volatility not long after. That has led to the need for an energy transition, which is causing all sorts of global instability. So Keir Starmer, in a relatively small island off the Eurasian landmass, a rainy set of islands, trying to navigate a path through this raging geopolitical context, it's very difficult to chart a course because the asymmetric shocks that are going to impinge upon Britain are going to be there. Ukraine, war in the Middle East, there could well be a war in the Indo-Pacific. And I think the instability in Africa is going to increase. So, I hate to paint a gloomy picture in this first visit to your show in the new year. But it's a very tough road ahead, I think, for the world. And I haven't even mentioned Trump and potential meltdown in America.
There are no sunny uplands anymore. That's sort of the problem.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I suppose it's that's good for us to like to say as commentators to sort of lay out the lie of the land. I just wonder whether ultimately Keir Starmer isn't a commentator. He's got to try and motivate people to go out on whatever pretend sunny spring day or miserable autumn morning, depending on when the election comes, to motivate people. If he isn't at least suggesting that he might be able to deliver meaningful change to people's lives, then there is a risk. And people in the Labour Party I speak to, they talk about, you know, the apathy and a shrug of the shoulders is one of the big threats to the Labour Party. You do need to motivate people to at least think it's possible that things get better. But if you just say, well, it's all a bit gloomy and we can't really do much and it'll tell all the situation, but we'll sort of do it, you know, we'll basically do the same as the Tories, but we'll feel sadder about it. He's got to be a salesman as well, isn't he, Manfred?
Yeah, he does. But I think at the moment, it's very hard. If you hear any politician telling you how great life is going to be in a year's time, you instantly disbelieve it because nobody, you know, as Matthew was pointing out, there are so many challenges coming down the road. It's impossible to know what, you know, the great vision for Britain in a year or 2 years or even four sort of looks like. You know, it's going to be a difficult path. All you can rely on is a government that's going to be in the best position to navigate it. And I think in terms of that, what he's trying to do today, and I'm not saying he's doing it very effectively, but what he's trying to do is sort of, I don't think he sounds enthusiastic saying anything. That's probably just his voice. But I think what he's trying to set out is that I will be the most competent person to do it. And he's making it more about character than policy or where this all ends. It's all about sort of, if you have to choose one of us to get us to get the country through it, then this is why you should pick me. And, you know, there's lots of sort of little digs at people who don't take politics seriously. You know, the idea that Boris Johnson and Cameron are only in it for fun almost. I mean, this is all sort of, you know, don't pick the public school boys. They won't understand the problems you're going through in a cost of living crisis. I'm the person to do it, which isn't a great sort of sense of hope. It doesn't sort of make you feel like things are about to get better. What it's relying on really is telling you that if you don't vote for Labour, things will only get worse. And that's it's not an optimistic vision. It's more it's more the sort of 1920s American sort of evangelical priests who would go around telling you that if you didn't vote for if you didn't support them, it was more the doom that you're trying to ward off rather than the great sort of vision of a fun future.
Well, let's take off all this doom and gloom then and all this negativity. Maybe it's just our age, because let's talk about a young man who can be very optimistic about the future, Luke Littler. He lost last night, but blimey, what a run to get to the finals of the PDC World Darts Championship. And Matthew, you've written about that moment of young, particularly in sport, young people who sort of seem to just shake off all of the pressure and the worries and just throw themselves into it. Emma Raducanu being another one. And there's something about young people without all the doom and gloom that comes with being a bit older, just throwing themselves into it and actually seeming to enjoy it.
Yeah, I love the darts this year. I watched it with my son yesterday. My daughter had a sleepover, so she wasn't with us, but we watched the semi-final all together. And it's incredible. I think back to being a ping pong player in my teens and 20s. And when I was young, I was completely fearless when it got to deuce, 20 all. I would go for attacking shots, not thinking about the consequences if I missed, because I didn't have any responsibility at all. Didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have a job I had to protect. None of these things that you feel that you have to discharge your responsibilities properly as you get older. And so I took risks, and I was very good under pressure. And Luke Littler, in his run to the final, there was a checkout in the semis, bull, double 16. I just can't imagine an older darts player having even thought about, let alone attempted. He was very close to winning last night. Probably too much information. He got 4-2 up. He went treble 18, and he doubled 2 to go 5-2. He would have won, and it was right on the wire. But the other guy, I've got to say, the guy who won it, Luke Humphreys was also fantastic last night. It's such a great... I love the darts at this time of year.
But it was... I really enjoyed your piece because the Emma Raducanu, and actually, she, you know, she's done... I think she lost actually last night, but she's been playing better. But the example that you used, that when she won the US Open, she did it, you know, she was very young, she sort of sailed through it, she even talked on court about how she was enjoying herself. And then along with that comes all the pressures of being brand ambassadors and, you know, it's suddenly you've got a grown-up job off court or off, you know, off the hockey or whatever it might be. And that sort of adds all that pressure. Even if you haven't got a mortgage, you suddenly feel like you owe what you're doing to lots of other people. Whereas when you're young, you can just do it for the love of doing it.
It's easy to forget why you are playing sport. When you start, you kick a football around the field, not because you're going to earn money, but because it's just pure joy and you're creative and you're immersed and absorbed in what you're doing. And then later when paycheck starts coming in and you're a sponsor and you have a brand ambassador, it can subtly change the meaning of what you're doing. You know, I don't think that's just true of sport, by the way. You think of some of the great scientific innovators, you know, Einstein solving whatever it was, a special theory of relativity, just completely immersed in the fun of trying to unravel the deep patterns of nature. And then you think of older professors who are trying to seek tenure or trying to be published and they're seeing their work as a job. It does change the cycle. You know, funnily enough, I was thinking about when I first started writing for the Times in my late 20s and David Chappell, the sports editor back then, when I phoned directory inquiries and got through to him and said, I'd like to write some pieces for the Times. He said, yeah, could you fax in some idea? This shows how long ago it was. And it was just completely intoxicating to be a published writer, and I completely loved it. And I think it has changed a bit, and I think it takes a bit of discipline to try and rediscover the joy that we ought to find in the things that we do in life. And I think Luke Littler and Rooney and Tiger Woods and Raducanu, they're wonderful reminders of that.
Actually, because when reading your piece, it made me think a bit about when I was in my early 20s and doing comedy stuff with two friends. We had a sketch group. And then we stopped doing it because we all got proper jobs and girlfriends and other responsibilities, you know, mortgages and whatnot. And actually, I've, in the last couple of years, gone back to doing stand-up. And it's just a reminder of just doing things because you really enjoy doing them is a nice thing. What do you think, Mavie?
Yeah, I loved Matthew's column on this. I think he's right. You know, I think watching people in their element because they just enjoy doing something, just for the sheer love of it, rather than the paycheck and the responsibilities. It also made me think, because I think he's right, I think it extends far beyond sport. And, you know, I remember once here talking to the writer Ian Wilson, sort of saying he'd just read a book and he thought, has written with such flair and such wisdom. This must be written by sort of a 70-year-old who spent his entire time this, you know, at least 60 of those years reading great tomes. And it turned out it was written by somebody who was about 20. And he said, you would only have that kind of flair when you're and confidence when you're very young, when you're not constantly double thinking everything. And I think that's part of it too. I think the fear of risks and the fear of sort of the responsibilities you carry sort of makes you overthink everything after a particular stage. And I think that's quite interesting too. Yeah. It's when it's just the pure thought before you've brought in all your anxieties around it.
That's so, sorry, Matt, can I jump in there? I think that's so true. There's a phenomenon in sport called choking. In darts, it's called dartitis.
And
it happens when you start to think.
Exactly.
Overthink. So instead of hitting the ball naturally, spontaneously, using what's called your unconscious competence, you start to think, I've got to get the bat angle right and I've got to make sure it lands on the table. And you're thinking so much, it slows you down and you become completely stilted. And some darts players, they couldn't even release the dart because they were so analytical about what they were seeing. Wow. That kind of second guessing what one is doing, it destroys spontaneity and it destroys certain types of performance. The great polymath Ian McGilchrist has argued that we control these different aspects of what we do with the different hemispheres of the brain. There's a lot of work to be done on really understanding what creates what's sometimes called flow, being in the zone, which is often an unconscious competence, and it's a wonderful place to be. I rarely get there anymore.
Exactly. I think it's an age thing. I think as you get older, you start overthinking and you start sort of, maybe it is a different part of your brain that sort of starts to take precedence.
But it even happens, I don't know, if you're not playing at the top level, but if you're doing like crazy golf or having a game of pool or something with mate, and as soon as you sort of start thinking about it, it all goes wrong.
But broadcasting must be similar to this. I mean, on the mic, you can't overthink, Matt. Am I right? Otherwise,
nobody would accuse me of overthinking on the mic. Now, Manvin, Matthew, have you been watching ITV's Mr. Bates versus the Post Office?
Haven't seen it.
Matthew's been watching the darts. We know that. We know that much.
I haven't seen it, but I followed the scandal.
You're very familiar with the scandal. The Post Office scandal, which thousands of sub-postmasters and so post mistresses, of course, were accused of financial mismanagement. Hundreds were prosecuted, and some were sent to prison. We've been following it all this week, so obviously been back in the news. But we thought we'd speak to someone who's been in exactly this position. Wendy Buffery is a former postmistress from Cheltenham and joins us now on the live. Wendy, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
You might be sick of doing this, but just run us through what happened to you and the situation you are now in.
One morning when I was doing my stock, I had a load of stamps appear on my computer, which shouldn't have been there. So I reversed them out and it gave me a loss of £9,000 because it presumed that I'd sold them. So I checked all the paperwork and how to do it and took them out, put them back in, and then took them out again, like it told me to do, and that raised it to an £18,000 loss. And I thought, well, I've definitely done something wrong here. So I went through the manual and I did everything it said to do on the manual, and then I had a £36,000 loss.
Wow.
So at that point, my life fell apart.
And you were then prosecuted for stealing, they alleged, obviously, you know, we now know
for stealing
£26,000.
Yeah, well, I'd managed to max my credit cards out and everything and put £10,000
to try and pay back the money that actually was a mistake and not money that you'd taken. And you, and then, I mean, this had a devastating, I mean, as anyone would imagine, it had a terrible effect on you, didn't it? You told the public inquiry, which is going on to this, that you even went as far as thinking about taking your own life.
I went to a local hill that I usually walk on to do my thinking, and I took some tablets up there with me and some water, and was about to take them when I had a phone call from Joe Hamilton, one of the other sub post mistresses, and I found out that I wasn't the only one. And we spoke for about 2 hours on the phone, and then I found myself back at my car, and I hadn't taken them, and drove home to let my husband know that we weren't the only ones. There were a lot of other people that were affected.
And that's so crucial, isn't it? And anyone who's watched the drama will have seen this, that because you kept being told by the post office and Fujitsu, oh, no, you're the only one. Nobody else has had these troubles. That's why you'd have felt so isolated.
Yeah, I think they relied on the fact that people who take on a post office are proud people. Mm. And you don't want to think you've made a mistake.
Yeah. And also, I suppose, as well, you're right in the centre of the community, and the terrible backlash you then get when people think you have been stealing something. Let's bring in Matthew and Manvin. Matthew, it strikes me that the reaction, particularly by the post office, just defending their brand at all costs, regardless of the impact on people. But we see this across public and private bodies.
Yeah, I think one might describe it as a kind of institutional narcissism. I think occasionally we see this in the NHS, where instead of doing the right thing, recognising that a mistake has been made, ensuring that patients or professionals are properly treated, they close ranks. They try and defend their reputation above all else. You saw it with the Roman Catholic Church. Mm. And I mean, it's harrowing to hear the testimony and what people have gone through. Has there been any proper prosecutions of the people who behaved in this way? Has there been any redress?
Well, I think from what I understand is the public inquiry is ongoing now, and then that could then, some of those involved said there's enough evidence that the police then could look into it. Mavi, just get your thoughts on this just briefly, because we are short of time, but I'm keen to bring you in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's utterly Kafka-esque. You know, it's appalling on behalf of the organisations to cover this up. And you've got, you know, I know that the public inquiry is looking at this, but the executives at the top who allowed this, you know, lies basically to be spread and ignored, you know, people were dying. People were trying to kill themselves. People died before they saw justice. I think it's absolutely horrific. But it's also just Kafka-esque as, you know, a person in this country, you assume there are systems and, you know, you will get justice. And to have gone through this for 20 years when the evidence was there and yet just to meet denial upon denial from both the corporation and from government is just, I mean, it's unimaginable. I don't know how they've coped. Huge respect,
absolutely. And Wendy, you're so lucky that you got that call. Wendy. Just finally, Wendy, obviously your prosecution was quashed. We were talking to Kevin Hollenrake about this earlier, the Post Office Minister. Have you had compensation?
No.
You're one of those still waiting.
Yeah, I've had interim payments.
Yeah.
No, I've not had an offer as yet. But I don't class it as compensation.
No, absolutely, yes. Alan Bates was
back to where we were before this happened.
It's just taking you back, giving you back money that you shouldn't have lost in the first place.
That they've offered us for what they've done to us is less than a third of Nick Reed's bonus last year.
Incredible. Wendy, we really appreciate you sharing your story with us today. That's Wendy Buffery there, former postmistress from Cheltenham. Really, and we'll keep on the story because the reaction we've had from listeners has been incredible. Mavi Rana and Matthew Syed there. And of course, you can read the very best political analysis in The Times and The Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription at thetimes.co.uk.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
This is a public service announcement. The politicians are coming for you.
I just haven't met you yet.
And when I get the people who got start-up loans coming into Downing Street and telling me what they've done, taking a risk, having a punt, having a go, that pumps me up.
I'll never give up.
And it's very nice to see you. It's a disaster. Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman.
I have no doubt that the Conservative Party and the Conservative government will have 5 more years of work in office. Thank you for being here today.
But there isn't a magic money tree that we can shake that suddenly provides for everything that people want.
Am I tough enough? Tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Right, who's next? Anyone else? All good?
No others from you. Anyone else have some questions before we get over to the media? Okay, gosh, it's very quiet. I just haven't met you
yet. The perils of the politicians meeting the public. Well, when things are looking bleak in the polls, you think the media is against you and advisers are suggesting you need to get out and about to talk to real people. So what seems to be happening for Rishi Sunak right now? People need to see the real Rishi. Let Rishi be Rishi. Well, we've just heard there. David Cameron, one of his Cameron Direct events. John Major on his soapbox. Ed Miliband showing his tough is tough enough. Theresa May being grilled by a nurse. Gordon Brown demonstrating the dangers of meeting an actual voter. And Rishi Sunak there demonstrating his easy nature with members of the public. So now he, after being accused of being tetchy with the media last year, we are told he's going to hit the road to try and convince people one voter at a time. He's in the Midlands today for his first public appearance of the new year. Let's hope it goes better than when he met a homeless man.
What's your name?
Dean.
Dean, how are you?
Hungry.
Well, we hope we get you some good breakfast. What do you have? Do you work in a business? Do you want some fruit?
No, I'm homeless, and I'm actually a homeless person.
Oh, I mean, you can't help feeling sorry for them sometimes. So, will letting the public see the real Rishi Sunak help turn around his fortunes? We talked about it on this week's How to Win an Election. Here's Danny Finkelstein.
So there's this thought that this all comes from this Let Bartlet Be Bartlet. But in fact, it comes from It comes from Let Reagan Be Reagan. And Let Reagan Be Reagan, which was the original use of this phrase, was a campaign by the right in the Conservative Party against his more centrist advisers, that Reagan should be his authentic Conservative self. Let Reagan be Reagan. Yeah. The reason that I think let Ed Miliband, for example, be Ed Miliband is I think authentically Ed Miliband was well to the left of where he then decided to present himself, and therefore it wasn't good advice for him. And I think also with Gordon Brown, letting Gordon Brown actually be what he really was would have also moved him, you know, against, for example, the agenda of sort of more austere spending that Alistair Darling put in place. So it was not good advice to him.
We can hear more from Danny Finkelstein, Peter Madison and Polly McKenzie on this week's edition of the How to Win an Election podcast. So today we thought we'd look back at some of the best and worst moments of politicians meeting the public. A trip down memory lane. And we'll speak to some of the advisers who were stood just out of shot, sometimes with their head in their hands. Let's start with John Major and his soapbox. It's often the template for leaders since. Halfway through the 1992 general election campaign, John Major decided to return to the style he'd learned as a young man in South London, where on Saturdays he'd regularly harangue shoppers from a soapbox near Brixton Market.
When the demonstrators are pushed to one side and the ordinary people of Britain speak, I have no doubt that the Conservative Party and the Conservative government will have five more years of work in office. Thank you for being here today. Thank you.
Well, obviously it worked in 1992. Less successful in 1997. Well, Hal James was political secretary to John Major, joining actually in 1994 and then in the rundown to the election in 97. Morning, Hal.
Good morning.
One of the things that struck me looking back at John Major on his soapbox is how actually makeshift it was. There wasn't loads of security. There weren't loads of people with pre-printed banners. It did seem like his authentic self.
Yeah, no, I think it was. And as you said at the beginning, it did derive from his real behaviour. You know, back in the day when he was a kid in Brixton, he used to stand on the corner and shout his wares, so to speak. So I think this was a sort of, people did perceive it as a natural behaviour for him. So it wasn't as though he was stepping outside the bounds. And it was makeshift. I mean, it was a box, actually. It was a box from the central office that contained documents and files. And he got, it happened, I'm told, I wasn't there, of course, because it was pre my time, in 92. But it happened spontaneously because he had gone to I think it was in Cheltenham, and there were a lot of people out in the street jostling, and the cameras caught all this, and he returned to the sort of bus, and they got a box out for him so he could stand up higher than the crowd around him. So it did happen, and I think people saw it happen sort of authentically. Both in terms of his own behaviour and in terms of it not looking like a sort of set piece, prepared political action, I think it ticked both those boxes. But clearly it also, you know, it also, I think, offered him a way of talking to people and talking to the media over the commentators. It frustrated him hugely that, you know, once with, you know, particularly in 97, which is sort of the period I can talk about with more sort of personal experience, the narrative, the media narrative, once your polls are in a certain place, once you've had a few initiatives that have sort of been launched and then stumbled and not kind of done the job for you, you know, the narrative becomes everything is a sort of a fight back, everything. So you look very reactive. And the thing about the soapbox is it gave him an opportunity to stand up and look proactive and stand up and make his case directly to the public and in a way directly through the television cameras.
It was making a virtue of some of the public anger, being seen to take, particularly in 97 even, being seen to take some of the public anger. I was looking up some cutting. I think it was the Independent reported in 97. John Major returned to the soapbox yesterday to launch his election fight back in a near riot. He showed he lost none of his street fighting spirit, surrounded by policemen. He was heckled. An empty drinks can was thrown as the scrum with the Prime Minister in the centre careered along the high street. And actually, there's a bit of that. And the next example I wanted to bring in, Hal, is from Ed Miliband. It was a bit later on. Ed Miliband didn't have a soapbox. He had what can only really be described as a pallet. All the people who stood around him were essentially sort of Labour Party supporters. It was all a bit more staged. We couldn't find a clip of him standing on his pallet. So lacking in news, was it? But here he is instead speaking to Jeremy Paxman in 2015 during the election campaign in front of a live studio audience.
You understand what the point is here. The point is people think you're just not tough enough. Well, let me tell you. Am I tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Not tough enough to stand on a soapbox, though. Let's bring in, Hal James, stay there, but let's bring in Times Radio's very own Aisha Hazarika, who worked for Ed Miliband, as well as Gordon Brown and Harriet Harman. Hi, Aisha.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Are you tough enough, Aisha?
Hell yeah.
Now, explain Ed Miliband's palette and the idea behind it. Clearly trying to draw comparisons with John Major and him winning in 92, but it lacked maybe that bit of spontaneity?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it wasn't really, I would say, born out of people sitting down going, oh, let's recreate John Major. I think it's sort of more what you said at the beginning in the intro to this piece. What politicians at some point always suddenly alight upon, along with their advisors, is right, we've got to try and look authentic. We've got to try and look like we're not scared of the public. But the reality is, by that point in their career, particularly being a leader of a political party, they're not just scared of the public, they pretty much loathe the public as well, because the public are the people who are going to give them a hard time. And this very odd thing happens where when you become a political leader, you are in this incredibly rarefied world. You have a whole team of advisors. You don't have to do anything for yourself. You're very rarely alone by yourself. You have a driver. And then suddenly, with an election coming, you get switched into, right, you've now got to pretend to be a real person and sort of engage with real people when, you know, you've not bought a coffee or done your own laundry for like the last 3 years, basically. So I think that's one of the reasons why this stuff always kind of jars a bit, because there is a natural inauthenticity to it, because you have been living in this very sort of weird special political bubble for such a long time.
As we saw when Rishi Sunak struggled with a card machine. Let's keep picking through the history books, because some of these are great. And obviously, you know, sometimes you get out and about, people want to bend your ear and get quite cross. This was back in 2001. This is Sharon Storer, who was the partner of the angry partner of a cancer patient, confronting Tony Blair.
The staff is absolutely incredible on the ward. They can't do enough for the patient. And then he has to be referred down to an A&E unit, which was absolutely absolutely diabolical and you suffer terribly. So would you like to tell me what you're going to do to provide those people with better facilities?
That's exactly what we're trying to do.
I hope you do, because it's absolutely appalling, and if you'd just like to go and have a look at it, then you'll find out just how terrible it really is.
I'm very sorry about the situation.
No, you're not very sorry, because if you was, you would do something about it.
Tony was there trying to placate her. Who knows what he said about her afterwards? We do know what Gordon Brown said about Gillian Duffy after he met her in 2010 in Rochdale.
And it's very nice to see you. That was a disaster. She'd never have put me with up with that woman. Whose idea was that?
I don't know, I didn't see.
That's Sue, I think. They're just ridiculous.
I'm not sure they'll go with that one.
They will go with it. Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman that said she used to be a lady. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, so let's bring in now Mark Lucas, who is director of presentation for Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Mark, is it fair to say that Tony Blair was just better with members of the public than Gordon Brown? Although we did go through exactly this period with that we are now with Rishi Sunak, where we're being told that he's so much better in person, and if only he could meet everyone individually, he could turn things around. Is that a fair reading, Mark?
I think so. I mean, if I had a quid for every election in which, after having tried to protect their leader for, you know, for years and years, they suddenly say, if only could meet everybody in Britain, we would win this election massively. That comes up every, honestly, I've worked in, I don't know, however many countries, every country, it's a universal. And somehow the people around the leader or the leader themselves suddenly begin to believe that they have the secret of interaction with other human beings and that that can win them the election. And the problem with it is it's just not true. It's just as simple as that. You know, I mean, Gordon, touched by genius, in my opinion, a heart of gold, which I think too few people know or have seen. But you wouldn't have said social interaction was his, you know, his forte. He would go to an NHS visit, you know, at a hospital, and he'd say to everyone, thanks for all you do for the NHS, thanks for all you do for the NHS. And I've been there on more than one occasion when he's thanked his own team for all they do for the NHS as well, you know. So, you know, it's just not true that everyone can interact with the public in an authentic and meaningful way. And I do suspect that if you can't, you shouldn't try it, because I admire John Major, actually. You know, we took him apart, obviously, in 97 in the last stages. But I think there's a lot to admire about him. And I think his journey was authentic, and the soapbox was an authentic expression of who he was.
There was something about Jeremy Corbyn sort of addressing people from the top of a fire engine or leaning out of a window or something. He spent his whole life addressing sort of rabble rousing a crowd, Aisha.
Yeah, I think the authenticity thing is, but you've got to do something which is comfortable. Like Rishi Sunak would be better off just like hovering in a helicopter over towns with a sort of megaphone. I think that's the kind of vibe we could sort of get behind.
We've talked a lot about Labour leaders. Let's turn our attention now to some Conservative leaders. David Cameron, he did a lot of these. I remember him coming and doing one at the Western Morning News when I worked there. Cameron directs, where he'd just take on all comers when he was leader of the opposition. Then he became PM direct. Here he is getting very overexcited in 2015.
When I hold those receptions at Downing Street, and when I get the people who got start-up loans coming into Downing Street and telling me what they've done, often giving up a well-paid career, taking a risk, having a punt, having a go, that pumps me up.
Gets me every time. Then Theresa May, slightly more awkward with members of parliament, I think it's fair to say, not one of life's raconteurs. And didn't go on brilliantly well when interacted with people on Question Time during the 2017 general election. She was asked whether she could sleep happily while NHS staff use food banks.
My wage slips from 2009 reflect exactly what I'm earning today. So how can that be fair in light of the job that we actually do?
And I recognise the job that you do. I'm being honest with you in terms of saying that we will put more money into the NHS, but there isn't a magic money tree that we can shake that suddenly provides for everything that people want.
And that went down really badly. And then Boris Johnson. I mean, it goes down very well when he's meeting members of the public, but often during elections, when he was running for mayor and when he was running in the general election 2019, they tried to keep him on a tighter leash, including famously hiding in a fridge to avoid ITV's Good Morning Britain in 2019.
You're live on Good Morning Britain. Could you talk to Piers and Susanna for me?
I'll be with you in a second. I'll be with you in a second.
Yeah, I have an earpiece here in my hands, ready to go. Right, he's been taken inside, into the freezer.
He's gone into the fridge.
There's a bunker.
It's very heroic work,
we've had
mate.
So far, isn't it?
Well, somebody who has tried to get Boris Johnson to behave himself over the years is Katy Perry, a former advisor to him during his two runs for London Mayor, later Director of Communications in Downing Street for Theresa May. Hi, Katy.
Good morning.
Am I right in characterising that actually during election campaigns, Boris Johnson was kept under a tight leash and you tried not to make him too interesting?
Well, yes, because Boris Johnson would want to do media every hour of the day. And you'd often say, we've got a big announcement coming on Monday, so we're not going to talk about it till Monday. And then he'd meet with the journalists on Friday and tell them all about the big announcement that he was meant to be launching on Monday. So it was always quite difficult to make sure that he stuck to the kind of the plan.
And what about Theresa May? Is it fair to back her with Gordon Brown in terms of her slight awkwardness for members of the public?
Yeah, I mean, very much like what previous people said, that actually in private, she was much more engaging. She actually had a really good sense of humour, would crack a few jokes. One-on-one was much more personable, but the minute the camera went on, she really didn't like it. And it was almost as if she would have been a brilliant Prime Minister in 1930, 1940, but just didn't understand what the media wanted from her. Yeah. And didn't understand why the members of the public wanted to hear more about their Prime Minister than they might not know that much about. And it was always a bit of an uphill struggle getting her to do the media that we wanted her to do, not just the set pieces, you know, what the updates, the things that she might have done when she was previously Home Secretary, but the more personable interviews, the things about what makes her tick, you know, what her private life's like, what does she like doing, the things that people want to know about their Prime Minister. She just didn't want to go there.
So go on then. We've got a good 30 years worth of political history covered across our full panel here. What would be your advice to Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer? Because it's interesting, I suppose if you're running to be you're the leader of the opposition, you want to look more prime ministerial, while the prime minister wants to look less prime ministerial, more like a man of the people, possibly. Let's ask you all then, your advice for what should Rishi Sunak do? Hal James, first of all, former political secretary to John Major. What's your advice to Rishi Sunak?
Be less manicured, be less controlling. I think, you know, when you're in the place that he is in the polls and in the public perception, I think he can afford to take risks now. And I think if he goes around and does public meetings with tame Tory audiences asking slightly flat, safe questions, it won't work for him. He needs to be bolder. And I think I'd encourage him to get out and about, and I would encourage him to take on all comers. Alistair Campbell, you know, the famous phrase, you know, time to take a kicking. There is a moment where taking on difficult questions and having, you know, things that may not immediately look very attractive, and you know, when they're relayed on the 6 o'clock news, the public give you a bit of credit, you know, for going out and taking on some arguments and putting your case in difficult environments. And it seems to me that avoid the too manicured, too tame environment and go out and accept that you're going to have to get a bit punchier and take on some of the tougher issues.
I wonder actually whether it'd be better, because they put out some videos over Christmas, didn't they? One of him sort of buying Christmas snacks or something. But Number 10 filmed that and put it out, and actually letting other people film it. And then, you know, it becomes more, you know, goes viral on its own, might make it seem a bit more authentic. Mark Lucas, former director of presentation for Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. What's your advice to Rishi Sunak?
Yeah, I mean, Alistair used to call that idea the masochism strategy, to take all the hits out in public and fully. And that works if your candidate can do that. But can Rishi do that? You know, I've seen his awkward smile. I've seen it when he's been challenged on interviews. And he just sort of freezes, really, and looks really awkward. And I think a series of scenarios where he freezes and looks really awkward and asks, you know, homeless people about investment strategies is just not going to win him the election. So I would say if they must have tested this, but if it's not going to work, don't do it, I would say, you know, although I hope they do, because I've got a feeling it'll be a disaster.
I suppose it also goes back to the fact he's still quite new into politics. You know, he was only elected in, 2015? He was selected in, I think, the first seat he ran. I might have got that wrong. You know, a safe Tory seat. He hasn't done sort of 20 years of pavement politics and all that. You know, he was quickly in the cabinet. Aisha, given all of your experience from Gordon Brown to Ed Miliband to Harriet Harman, what's your advice to Rishi Sunak, apart from shouting out of the door of a helicopter?
Well, look, the masochism strategy that both Howell and Mark have talked about, I think that only works, as Mark says, if you've got a brilliant performer. I actually worked on Tony Blair's 2005 election campaign when antisocial behaviour and law and order was a big issue. And I remember we took him to one event. It was like a council estate and everyone was absolutely fizzing with anger about the state of antisocial behaviour. And Tony Blair just stood there and took it. He took absolutely loads of people, absolutely sort of, you know, giving him a good sort of kicking. But then at the end of it, took them all on. At the end of it, they all lined up to sort of shake his hand. Now, I suspect that's not going to happen with a Rishi Sunak strategy. And I'm afraid, I think things are so bad for Rishi Sunak. If I were them, I'd probably hide. I'd get that fridge out of deep storage and I'd actually just get him to do set pieces. I think at this stage, it's too dangerous. It's too high risk. And the thing about getting someone else to film it, that can go so badly wrong. I don't know if you've ever remember a kind of background documentary that Vice did about Jeremy Corbyn, where it basically had Jeremy Corbyn's leaders going, just let him fail on his own terms and things like that. So I think those things tend to go viral. If I was them, I would just concentrate on bread and butter stuff and just do safe set. I would be very, very safe at this point.
Oh, there we are. But Katy Perry, your advice to Rishi Sunak?
I think Aisha's right that that it should be quite controlled and safe safe opportunities. I don't think that Rishi, the more that we see of Rishi on TV, is going to suddenly move the dial at all. He's got to also play to the things that people think he's good at. And they are things that drive people mad in government in terms of attention to detail or making sure he wants to deliver on some of the things that he's promised. And so, you know, play to the strengths rather than trying to make out something you're not. There is nothing worse than seeing a politician trying to fake it till you make it, trying to be all things to all people that they're not. So sometimes it's better to just admit that you're not brilliant at everything and focus on what you are good at and lean into that a little bit more. You know, when politicians make out they support one football team and forget and get it the wrong one, when they, you know, say they like things but they don't actually, when they get put on the spot, he's just better off being more authentically Rishi. We might think that that has some flaws, but actually he's better off playing to that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what impact all of that has on the voters, and we'll find out next week in our latest Times Radio focus group, asking people who voted Tory last time, now saying they're going to vote Labour, what they make of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer's new year relaunches. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me by emailing matt@times.radio or tell us what you think about the podcast by reviewing it wherever you're listening to it. If you listen to this on Apple, stick a review on there, lovely. Or better still, post on your social medias, tell your friends to listen to Politics Without the Boring Bits. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.